From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, a scientist searches for answers for what's causing California's severe drought.
I often get asked, is the drought caused by global warming, or is a particular heat wave caused by global warming?
Then we'll see how well the San Francisco PUC can keep water from leaking out of aging pipes.
It's sort of an art more than a science right now.
And we'll think about the future of how we get our water.
We'll think about building little miniature treatment plants either in housing developments or in the basements of buildings. And this will be the distributed water system of the future.
The drought's on tap today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Today, we're going to be looking at the impacts and potential causes of California's drought. KALW's water editor, Audrey Dilling, is here to help me do that. Hey, Audrey.
Hi, Hannah.
So, what's the latest?
Well, last week, Governor Jerry Brown proposed two bills that would direct $1 billion of emergency funding to address the drought.
We all face a challenge because California, for 10,000 years, had only 300,000 or so residents. When you up that number to 38 million, and you increase the amenities and the consumption, you get a problem when you're in the middle of a desert.
So the governor wants $1 billion of emergency funding. Audrey, where would that money go?
Well, the majority of it would go to water recycling, seawater desalination, and flood protection projects around the state. And that's money that's already been approved by voters in previous bonds. Governor Brown is just looking to expedite that spending. And he's doing the same thing with some money already earmarked in this year's budget to help farming communities hit hardest by the drought.
Okay, so that's how the governor is responding to the water crisis. Make the money flow faster. We'll hear more from you, Audrey, later on in the show. First, let's turn to what could be causing the drought. The lack of rain and unusually high temperatures that we're experiencing are like nothing we've seen in 120 years of recorded history.
We're trying to understand what's causing an individual extreme event like the drought, and then to ask objectively whether or not global warming could have played a role. What are the odds that global warming has played a role?
That's Noah Diffenbaugh from Stanford University's Woods Institute for the Environment. He was one of the first scientists to come out and say global warming most likely is causing the drought. NASA predicts climate change could cause water shortages that last for 10, 20, 30 years. So what does that mean for the Bay Area? KALW's Liz Pfeffer went to find out where research and reality meet.
It's Wednesday afternoon at San Francisco's Heart of the City Farmers Market. Twice a week, this gritty plaza is transformed by dozens of white canopies and truckloads of fresh produce. The air smells earthy and sweet, and I can't help thinking about how much water it takes for all these veggies to grow. Because in this spot I'm standing in, it didn't rain once in January, which is supposed to be the wettest month of the year in California. So you gotta wonder, if your business relies on water, what's the game plan? Mike Ving of Ving's Farm is selling mustard greens, cauliflower, broccoli.
Got maybe 12, 13 different kinds of tomatoes here. It's nice, sweet, firm, and delicious.
But two items are missing from his tent: winter greens and root vegetables. They need colder weather and lots of water and just wouldn't grow this season. A few stalls away, Rob DeSanto of Far West Fungi talks mushrooms.
Psychedelic mushrooms.
Unfortunately, no, man. You gotta go to the park.
Most of the mushrooms, like especially the white or the brown, are like 60% water, actually. So those ones need quite a bit.
DeSanto says they grow up to 40 beds of typical white mushrooms at a time. So that variety alone needs about 220 gallons of water per day. That's why they have to adapt. Far West Fungi is buying water from the Santa Cruz Water Department and conserving what's in their private well for the time being. Otherwise, if the extreme drought continues, their well will run dry in a couple of years. The drought isn't shriveling crops in the Bay Area, but I also spoke with honey sellers from Napa County, whose bees didn't have enough flowers to pollinate, and citrus producers from the Far East Bay, whose oranges were bitten by severe frost. Environmental scientists are wondering whether all these problems are caused by the same thing. Here's Stanford's Noah Diffenbaugh.
I often get asked, is the drought caused by global warming or is a particular heat wave caused by global warming.
When it comes to the drought, he says the probability is high, really high, that it is. His research team believes a region of persistent high atmospheric pressure deflecting storms from California was caused by human emissions of greenhouse gases. That's a lot to take in, so I'll let him explain it.
The metaphor that we think about is like a stream. You know, the stream being the storm track, the path of storms across the Pacific that really provide the bulk of precipitation in California, and the ridge of high pressure being like a boulder that is kind of dropped into a stream.
This atmospheric boulder has a nickname, the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge, and it's been disrupting the storm track on and off since this drought began, causing drier, warmer weather in California. And that's how scientists are putting a human fingerprint on the drought, or any extreme event, by proving that it was more likely to occur because of the climate conditions humans created, mainly from the fossil fuels we burn. Remember that dry January I mentioned? Well, California also just had its hottest February on record, driving scientists to question, what's next?
So the reason that we're interested in understanding whether or not global warming is influencing individual extreme events is so that we can understand the risks of climate change.
Like how changing weather can really impact people. Take the drought, for example. That affects agriculture, which is our food, and of course, drinking water. Steve Ritchie is from the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. He manages the entire Hetch Hetchy regional water system, and that means he's responsible for the water of 2.6 million customers in the Bay Area. We're standing on a peaceful bank of Calaveras Reservoir tucked into the Alameda watershed lands east of Fremont.
When it's your job to make sure that everyone in the area has water, at what point do you start freaking out over the drought?
I have to admit that last January, January of 2014, when we weren't getting any precipitation, I was scared.
Around the Bay Area, some reservoirs aren't where they should be this time of year, but we're in better shape than drier parts of the state. Here at Calaveras, the water level is low. I see a deep bathtub ring up to around the vegetation line along the rim. But in this case, that's by design, while a larger dam is being built downstream. So it can withstand strong earthquakes and expand to hold more water. As it stands now, Richie says his customers have enough water to survive 2 to 3 more years if it never rains again.
It's definitely an interesting state to be managing water in. How many times have you seen Chinatown?
That's a 1974 Roman Polanski film about California water. It's like asking a mob boss if he's seen The Godfather.
I have probably seen Chinatown at least 10 times.
Drought or no drought, much of California would be desert if not for human disturbance.
It's a Mediterranean climate. It's dry most of the year. One of my colleagues said one day, who else is in a business where you sell a product that you have no idea how much is going to show up? And I said, well, that's an interesting way to look at it.
That's what farmers and scientists and water agencies have in common, trying to find certainty in an already uncertain area. As science races to gain perspective on global warming and extreme weather, industries have no choice but to adapt. Plant fewer crops, use less water, build a bigger dam, and pray that it rains. For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Pfeffer.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. KALW's water editor Audrey Dilling is here with me too.
Yep, and we just visited the Calaveras Reservoir. That's just one part of the vast Hetch Hetchy regional water system, a system that carries water to more than 2.5 million customers in the Bay Area. And how it does that is remarkable. Remarkably simple, that is, according to David Briggs. Briggs is a water resource manager for the San Francisco PUC, or Public Utilities Commission.
Because it's gravity driven, largely, the Romans, if they were here today, they could probably understand how our system works.
That's thanks in part to how old the system is. It's not Roman Empire old, but some of the pipes carrying this water were put into the ground more than a century ago. So it might not surprise you that sometimes they break.
And that's the story we're about to hear about.
Yep, I went to see what the PUC is doing to prevent water leaks in the times of drought.
Okay, let's hear it.
If you've ever been driving along San Francisco's Mission Street and suddenly felt like you were on an old wooden roller coaster, you might have been somewhere around the intersection of Mission and Valencia. That's where I've met Roberto Lopez, a communications officer for the PUC. We're watching a work crew rip up the street with jackhammers.
And this project is a complete repaving of Mission Street, which, as you can see, this street desperately needs.
I hate driving on this street.
So it's a good thing.
The repaving of this part of Mission Street is just a welcome side effect of the real reason crews are working here, to replace an underground water main.
So the old pipe, it's run its course, kind of, you know, the end of its usefulness.
When Lopez says old, he means old. This pipe was installed in 1890. That means it survived the 1906 earthquake, for starters. But now it's time to put it out to pasture.
So this is preventative, right? Nothing went wrong with this pipe?
No, it's just that the water department prioritizes every year. We're going to do X miles of water main pipes a year. Where are the areas that need it the most?
There are 1,240 miles of water pipes running under San Francisco streets. If those pipes were people, about half of them would be retired by now, easily. In fact, 15% of them are more than 100 years old. So the PUC is gradually replacing them. This year, the agency aims to upgrade 9 miles worth of aging pipes. But that question Lopez raised about what parts of the system need fixing most, it's not so easy to answer.
It's hard.
That's PUC Water Resources Manager David Briggs.
The pipes underground, they're all buried. We can't dig them all up and saw them in half and look inside of them and look at, you know, and see how much pipe thickness is left. So we use a lot of indirect methods.
Like tracking which soil conditions corrode pipes fastest and targeting those lines first.
It's sort of an art more than a science right now.
According to Briggs, about 100 water mains bust every year. One broke in late January near the panhandle of Golden Gate Park and flooded the DMV next door. Another one busted at the beginning of this month in Glen Park and shut down a nearby muni line. Briggs says every break is different.
Sometimes it'll just manifest as a wet spot on the pavement, and it'll be an annoyance. Somebody might slip on it, and so we'll get a phone call about that or what's going on. Other times, somebody will cleave off a fire hydrant and put a 60-foot geyser in the financial district.
According to PUC data, about 8% of the city's water supply is lost to leaks. And in a drought, every drop counts. When Governor Brown declared a state of emergency last year, the PUC started asking customers to cut back on water use by 10%.
Leaking pipes and wasted water, of course, flies in the face of that. And the drought just magnifies it, and everybody's under the microscope right now.
If the drought gets a lot worse, Briggs says we could see something like mandatory water cutbacks, meaning customers would get a set amount of water to divvy up between doing dishes, taking showers, making coffee, everything.
How bad would it have to get for that to happen?
Well, I mean, it's a hard question to answer, but if it stopped raining in California for years at a time, we would be in a world that we'd never seen before. Things that may sound improbable or strange now may not be if precipitation in California is just too low.
To prepare for that world, the PUC is expanding the capacity of the Calaveras Reservoir to catch more of any rain we do get. And the agencies started looking underground for drinking water instead of relying just on what comes from the mountains. And over the next couple of years, the PUC will ramp up its repair rate of San Francisco's aging pipes to 15 miles per year, which means you'll be hearing a lot of this around the city.
Do you know how many projects like this are going on in the city right now?
Probably about anywhere from 10 to 15 water main projects throughout the city right now.
The PUC's Roberto Lopez says fixing up the system is kind of like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. Once you finish, you've got to start all over again. which means that in another 100 years, someone else could be standing right here, watching Mission Street get a much-needed makeover. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents. Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Audrey Dilling is here with me in studio. Hey, Audrey.
Hi.
We just heard a report from you about what the city is doing to hold on to precious water. How are we doing as a state?
Well, there was a lot of buzz recently around an LA Times editorial that reported that California's reservoirs are only holding about a year's worth of water.
Just a year's worth?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean we only have a year of water left. If we got some significant storms, they would add to that supply. Still, it's daunting data, coming just as we're leaving the traditional wet season behind and heading into springtime.
We did just get that sprinkle.
Yeah, it's a nice little reminder that there is still such a thing as rain. But we got less than like a 1/16 of an inch in San Francisco.
So, okay, not much. But if the skies stay dry, where's our future water going to come from?
I've been wondering that, too. And so has UC Berkeley professor of civil and environmental engineering, David Sedlak. His recent book is called Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. I sat down with him to talk about his ideas for building sustainable water delivery systems in the face of climate change. How are urban water systems set up today?
Our current system of bringing water into cities relies upon imported water sources. So for the majority of the Bay Area's communities, the water comes from the mountains. It's rainfall and snowmelt that falls in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And we have an intricate system of canals and aqueducts that bring the water into the Bay Area where we use it. It's an excellent system for bringing water into our cities up to a point. And that point is the expectation that climate change will mean that we won't be able to deliver as much water as we used to from this imported water system.
So how should we adapt?
The first and easiest strategy is to conserve water and be smarter about how we use water. We also need to find alternative sources that don't rely upon that rainfall and snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada mountains.
What are some of those sources?
One of the alternative sources of water that's getting the most attention is recycled water. That is, taking water that's been through a sewage treatment plant and applying another level of treatment to it and then delivering it to people's homes.
That's really expensive, right?
Relative to the other options, recycled water is not that expensive. The other options that are on the table are things like seawater desalination and capturing the rainfall that comes in the city and using it as part of our water supply.
In your book, you outlined kind of a two-pronged plan about decentralizing the water system. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The first and kind of most expedient approach to backstopping our decreasing water supplies is going to be centralized. So a lot of the early efforts in water recycling are going to happen at the existing water and wastewater treatment plants because that's the system we have. I think that the issue here is that the centralized water systems that we inherited from the Romans make a lot of sense in the most densely populated parts of our cities. So underground pipes and centralized water and sewage treatment plants are a wonderful idea for downtown San Francisco and Oakland and New York and Chicago and other big cities. But when we get to the suburbs and the edges of cities where most of the people actually live these days, we'll think about building little miniature treatment plants either in housing developments or in the basements of buildings. And this will be the distributed water system of the future.
So how would that work exactly?
Well, say you were going to build a new housing development on the edge of the Bay Area. Instead of building great big pipes to bring water from a centralized plant in the city and then big pipes to return the sewage, you might try to collect the water on the site, either by collecting water off the roofs of houses or using the shallow groundwater. And you might treat the water that people used on the housing development site and use it for landscaping and toilet flushing and firefighting.
Does that technology exist to do that right now?
Much of the technology for distributed water systems exists. It's just that it's quite expensive to build it in existing buildings. And so the opportunities to install it really arise when we expand our cities or when we replace buildings.
Have you thought about how a similar system that you imagine could be put in place in agriculture?
There are opportunities in agriculture to tie their water and energy and food production more closely to cities. So, for example, if you look at the Salinas Valley or you look at the Oxnard Plain in Southern California, you have large numbers of people living in close proximity to agriculture. And if you've ever driven down Highway 101 to Monterey, you go by those wonderful fields of strawberries and artichokes and fruits and vegetables, and they're being watered with recycled water. And that recycled water is coming from Salinas and the cities in the valley there. And so I could see more of this harmonization between cities and agriculture, especially as the population of the Central Valley grows.
That seems like they're kind of ahead of their times. How did they get to that place?
They got to that place by necessity. So back in the days before the recycling plant, they had overdrafted the groundwater aquifer and seawater was pouring into the groundwater system from the ocean, and they were only able to grow salt-tolerant crops like artichokes. And someone recognized that the wastewater could be treated and provide them with a much less salty source of irrigation water. And so the cities came together and tied all of their sewage collection networks into one centralized treatment plant that applies an additional level of treatment and distributes the water to the farmers. And so it was a win-win situation for the communities and the farmers. And now that land is much more valuable than it was before they started recycling the water.
When I read the first part of your book, which was about how early civilizations figured out how to get water into cities, and eventually we had these big cities and they got the water in and they needed to get the sewage out. There were parts where I was just like, what are you guys thinking? Like when they were putting the sewage just right into the river and it was flowing down into the city below it. Do you have any moments like this now when you're looking at the way that we handle water today?
Well, we build the infrastructure that's right for our generation. So our grandparents and great-grandparents built the infrastructure that made sense when California had 4 or 5 million people in it. But when California has 30 million and plans to have 40 million or more people in it, it's going to be a different infrastructure. And I think that one of the things that I hope our generation can do that our grandparents and great-grandparents didn't do was think about a sustainable future where we don't have to rebuild the system every generation.
That was David Sedlak, UC Berkeley Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and he spoke with KALW's Audrey Dilling. Thanks for joining us today, Audrey.
Thank you.
So if you have any drought story you want to see us cover, or if you want to let us know what the impacts are where you live, email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Better yet, give us a call. We're at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Jeremy Dalmas, Leela Day, Jack Detch, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Marcy Fraser, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Seth Samuel engineered today's show. The line producer was Angela Johnston. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Oakland band Brass Magic. They're playing at Off the Grid at Fort Mason in San Francisco this Friday night, starting at 5 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.